between artist Francis Elise, whose work is featured in the exhibition, and tonight's speaker, James Oles. I was talking about Mexico Inside Out, and I mentioned that, to my mind, and I don't think it's a stretch, it is a very ambitious and challenging exhibition. It's appreciated for what it has to teach us, as well as, I think, what it asks from us in the way of engagement and thoughtful consideration of issues that, while often specific to Mexico City, are also universal in their scope. We are so fortunate that the author and art historian James Oles has agreed to be here, back here tonight, to provide insight into the exhibition based on his personal and professional connection with much of the work in the exhibition as well as the artist who made it. James Oles is a senior lecturer in art at Wellesley College, where he also serves as adjunct curator of a Latin American art at the Davis Museum, where he advises on exhibitions and acquisitions. He teaches in the spring semester and spends the rest of the year in Mexico City, where he works as an independent curator and art historian. Jay earned a BA from Yale University, a JD from the University of Virginia, and a PhD in art history from Yale in 1995. He is a specialist in Latin American art, focusing as both scholar and curator on modern Mexican art and architecture from the 1910 revolution through the 1960s, though also he sometimes ventures further afield to places like Argentina or the U.S. Southwest. He is particularly interested in U.S.-Mexican cultural interchange. His first major project was called South of the Border, Mexico in the American Imagination, 1914 to 1947. He has written essays on topics ranging from the Mexican surrealist Pedro Friedberg to 1930s political prints to Art Deco architecture in Argentina to an archive of fake works by Frida Kahlo, and he has organized several major exhibitions in the United States and Mexico. In addition to Jay's personal insights into the modern's current exhibition, tonight's presentation coincides with the publication of his most recent book, Art and Architecture in Mexico. It's a 400-page survey published in the Thames & Hudson World of Art series, which has been described as a real page-turner due to its fresh approach and which, for our purposes, relates beautifully to any discussion on the modern's current exhibition. After the lecture tonight, you are invited to purchase Art and Architecture in Mexico in the museum store and then join Jay and me in the cafe for a book signing. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Jay. Please join me in welcoming Jay.
Hi, everybody. I've got a lot of stuff that I want to talk about tonight, so I'm going to launch right in. But I'm really honored to be part of this show. I didn't have anything to do with the organization of it, really, although I did meet both Allison and Andrea early on in the organization process. But I want to thank particularly everybody that's made my... I've had a few days stay in Fort Worth. This is only the second time I've been here, and I just had, like, this whirlwind. Well, I did everything. I went to Marshall's, and I went to and I had a personal tour of the Kimball collection with the director. So it's been a super few days. So this is the first time I've given this lecture. It's the first public presentation of this new book that just, in fact, the U.S. publication date was just on Monday. The Modern, in fact, has beaten out MFA Houston and San Antonio Museum of Art, where I'm giving the same lecture later in the month. So we'll just get started. This is the book. When I began talking with friends about writing a survey of Mexican art, because the truth is I usually talk with people about the book I want to write before I start writing it, so then the cat's sort of out of the bag and I actually have to write the book because I've been telling everybody I'm going to be writing the book. When I was doing this, I began discussing this idea of a survey that would cover the entire history of Mexican art and architecture since the Spanish conquest of the Aztec Empire, which basically took place in 1521. All the way up through contemporary art. When I was discussing this, my colleagues in the United States gave me a big slap on the back and said, wow, that's great, I can't wait to read the book, I'll assign it in my classes, et cetera, et cetera. My colleagues in Mexico, however, were somewhat more skeptical, both about the need for such a textbook in this day and age, but even more about any single scholar's ability to actually write one that would be worth reading, even if that scholar had spent much of his professional life living and working in Mexico, and even if there's no up-to-date single author survey covering this broad historical period in Spanish either. These two different reactions, the sort of good job, Jay, from my American colleagues, and the I'm not really sure you can do it from my Mexican colleagues, I highlight crucial differences between how Mexican art is actually taught and studied in the two countries. In Mexico, the entire educational system from beginning to end is far more centralized than it is here. And there's actually relatively few art history programs in Mexico. In fact, after very intense debates, the National University of Mexico, the country's biggest and most prestigious university, just approved having an undergraduate major in art history 2 years ago. Before that time, students in Mexico who were interested in art were enrolled usually either in a history department or in a studio art program, and they took art history through those disciplines. And specialized courses in art history were basically designed for graduate students. So introductory surveys that introduced people to Mexican art were actually pretty rare. And for the most part, students would end up taking courses that were taught by professors focusing on a much narrow historical period, like pre-Columbian art or colonial art or even 19th century art or perhaps just 19th century architecture, rather than getting an overview of the whole history. And so not surprisingly, in Mexico, books or exhibitions that deal with the entire history of Mexican art since the conquest were usually written by teams or done by teams of scholars, each focusing on their specific area. And few of those Mexican experts ever, and still even, and I know them today, they don't really feel comfortable trespassing on the territory of their colleagues down the hall, to say nothing of summarizing that territory in the classroom or for students or in books. Now, all scholars know the limits of any book that omits more than it can include and perforce tosses subtlety and footnotes to the wind. There's no footnotes in my book. There's a long bibliography, but there's no footnotes. But Mexicans have also been very wary of these totalizing art historical narratives, you know, the story of Mexican art from its beginnings, because purposefully or not, many of these earlier books, these earlier surveys, I'll be talking about them in a minute, whether they were survey texts, you know, one single author surveys, textbooks, or exhibitions that covered this broad historical period. In the past, particularly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, these sorts of books and projects tended to confirm, they were sort of centralized narratives written by one author, and they tended to confirm the centralized power of the Mexican government, and particularly the revolutionary institutionalized party of the revolution, which was in control in Mexico for 70 years, and as many of you know, came back into power last year. And these totalizing narratives, these big stories showing the grandeur of Mexico from the ancient past all the way up to the present, often tended to confirm the power of the ruling regime as sort of the heir of that great continuous tradition going all the way back to the Aztecs and before. And so art in Mexico was often used to confirm state power. But state power, the power of the Mexican regime, which in the centralized country like Mexico controlled most of the museums, the universities, etc., owned much of the art, in fact, was increasingly questioned after the repression of students and workers in the famous Tlatelolco massacre in early October 1968. And these images are just sort of placeholders, but you know, here you see Mexican treasures being hauled out as part of a sort of diplomatic statement of the nation's greatness. And this kind of use of Mexican art for political purposes was increasingly challenged after this massacre of students here in the plaza of Tlatelolco on October 2nd, 1968. And this is a photograph taken after that massacre. And I just want to point out this skyscraper here, which we'll be coming back to here at the end of the talk. The violent repression of students and workers in 1968 exposed the rotten underbelly of the PRI. And also in Mexico, so these surveys that confirmed the great state, national, Mexican culture, et cetera, were being questioned politically. But also, Mexican art historians didn't really have a need for these surveys because so much of the literature on Mexican art of all periods is obviously published in Spanish. The vast majority is published in Spanish. And these students could basically put together, professors could put together their own surveys by simply Xeroxing articles and making readers. That made the need for a survey much less in Mexico. In the United States, however, the situation is completely different. We don't have a centralized educational system, as you all know. There are thousands of art history programs with tens of thousands, if not over 100,000, I don't know, how many students in the United States take art history courses every year. It's a vast number. And at the undergraduate level, and some of you, how many of you, anybody study art history in college at all, you know? So at the undergraduate level, many people take art history kind of as generalists. You know, you study a little bit of this, you study a little bit of that. And it's part of a broader liberal arts education. So in that world, the idea of having survey classes that cover different countries or different periods in a broad way are much more common than they are in Mexico. And this, by the way, this tens of thousands of students taking art history in the United States, that's a big potential market. And that's, of course, why publishers like my own, Thames and Hudson, invest a lot of money in these very lavishly illustrated survey texts that cost only $26.95. So, now, all or some part of Latin American art is now being taught at a growing number of colleges and universities in the United States, probably at least 100 American colleges and universities offer some courses taught by specialists in some aspect of Latin American art. And that's a vast number compared to the 4 or 5 or 6 that were offering Latin American art when I was a graduate student in the 1980s. But there are also thousands more departments of history, of Latin American studies, of Latino studies, of Spanish or studio art, where students, at least potentially, might be interested in taking courses in Mexican visual culture as part of a broader curriculum, right? So, so there's just many more students with a need for a broad survey text in the United States than there are in Mexico. And although there are very few universities in the United States, a few now have multiple professors in art history departments, say, that teach different aspects of Mexican art. So there might be a pre-Columbianist and somebody specializing on colonial art and somebody specializing on modern art. There's a few. University of New Mexico, UT Austin are two examples. At most of the universities, colleges and universities in the United States where Mexican art is taught, the professor, somebody like me, will not have a colleague down the hall who can pick up where he or she leaves off or before they begin. It's all or nothing. Either I teach the whole history of Mexican art or I just leave huge chunks out of the curriculum altogether. Now, there's a bit of a chicken and egg dilemma here, because some people would say that before you can actually teach a survey class, you need a textbook that would be work for that survey. And other people say that it's first you need to develop the course and then you write the survey to meet the needs of the course. I think for the most part, my Mexicanist colleagues in the United States have been trying to teach this big picture of all of Mexican art without any single book that really worked in the classroom. No book could serve as an anchor for students to give them some grounding. And our students, for the most part, have little or no background in the history of Mexico. or the history of Mexican culture. And some have very little background even in the history of art. So you might get a Chicano student who wants to take a Mexican art course. They've never taken art before. They're not even really interested in the history of art, but they want to come to that class because of their background. And the flip side, you might have an art history student. She's been taking courses in France and Italian art and Baroque and, you know, African art. She doesn't know anything about Mexico or Latin America, but she wants to take this class. So you have these students with that really need this anchor. They really need this shared shared text that they can all build on. And that's really makes these textbooks much more of a force in the United States publishing world and academic world than in Mexico. So the available options for us who are interested in teaching surveys have been less than optimal, even if one tries to string together essays and book chapters published in English. Before this book that I wrote, the only survey in print, which is here on the left, A Guide to Mexican Art by the famous Mexican art historian Justino Fernandez, he's died in 1972. This book was, this in print, it was last revised in 1973. So, you know, 40 years ago. And it has very poor black and white illustrations. For several years, some of us used the far more luxurious exhibition catalog, Mexico, Splendors of 30 Centuries, which was published by the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 1990. It's kind of heavy. It wasn't too easy to read. It was so, you know, big, thick, giant exhibition catalog. And it has all the eccentricities of an exhibition catalog. It only illustrates the works of art, basically, that they could borrow for the show, maybe not always the works of art that you would want to teach from. But it is now out of print and anyway, and outdated. And anyway, like the Fernandez book, it leaves the story truncated. Fernandez was last revised in 1973, so forget having anything in art of the last 40 years in it. And Splendors of 30 Centuries, the curators decided to stop the story with Rufino Tamayo and his work of the 1950s. So it, too, excludes all the work of the past 60 years. So neither of these kind of had that big chunk of time, the late modern and contemporary period, that in fact is one of the areas that students are most fascinated by and want to know more about, and that's fast-paced, complicated, and neither of these books helped us in any way. So now, survey texts allow us to take stock of a specialized field. They force the writer to sit down and look and see what's been published, what's been done, and kind of synthesize from all of that one sweeping narrative. And I hope, Terry mentioned this, I hope a page turner. And I know that all authors want to tell you that their books are page turners, but I think mine is, hopefully. So, and I get no royalties from sales, so I just hope you buy it, but I don't get any royalties. So, but at the same time, you want to write a book that's a sweeping narrative that makes people want to read the whole book, but you also have to be careful about either, on the one hand, overcomplicating the story or oversimplifying the story. Rather than glorify Mexican culture, or structure my story around some important but maybe limited concept like mestizaje, this concept of cultural blending between indigenous and Spanish, I wanted to show, in fact, how the arts in Mexico were implicated in the construction of a far more complex and conflicted narrative, and something that was definitely not monolithic, a national identity that had been built over time in fits and starts by many different people from many different perspectives, and how actually Mexico was part of a much more global or international community from the very beginning, not only Spanish and indigenous, but also African and Asian and Filipino and people coming down from the United States or Europe as well in later years. I was eager to do in the book what I do in class and what I'm going to try to give you a sense of later in this talk, and that is to emphasize connections between artists or artworks rather than continuities or influences over time. And one of the aspects, in fact, that makes Mexico's cultural history so important is that as in a place like Italy, history is omnipresent, but it functions in very different ways. It's represented or deployed, interpreted, rejected, collaged, particularly by artists, in many, many different ways. There's no single line that takes us from then to now, but rather many. So all of those ideas got me the contract to write the survey. The task then became, how might I write a good one? Like all surveys, art and architecture in Mexico is the result of what one scholar calls, quote, the ideological sedimentation of the practices of art historians. So, and it's kind of a clunky phrase, but sedimentation, right? All of every art historian, everybody's working, good or bad, on all different periods. And from all of that work, you know, some things fall. They're a little heavier. Works of art, periods, ideas, concepts, artists. These things settle down from this vast pool, and you start to create what you start to call a canon, right? The things that everybody needs to know, the things that are more important or had a greater influence. And this sedimentation is like settling. And you know, when you settle, it's like settling. It settles down, but it's also you're settling for a shorter version than the big picture, because you're trying to sift out from all of that some story that you can tell. And this sedimentation, this process, takes place over years or decades or, in fact, even centuries. And its advantage is that it creates a canon, this set of classic works you're supposed to know. But that canon also functions as a type of shared genealogy or a shared frame of reference. And that is very important, particularly in the classroom, that the students have this sort of shared framework. And then against that, they can attack, fight, think, build, right? But they need something to hold on to in that way. Now, as is the case with many authors of survey texts, this process of selection or sedimentation was facilitated by years working as a teacher, even if I did not merely transfer my lectures to the written page. Instead, I offered my editors in London an outline of some basic ideas and a list of 200 images, buildings, paintings, sculptures, photographs, prints, drawings, that I thought were surely part of a story that I would want to tell. Works that, for the most part, I'd already been using in the classroom as key works. And by that, I mean this limited selection of works that students had to memorize. Students have to memorize far less than they did when I was in school, and they still complain about how much they have to memorize. But anyway, these key works, these are the works that they had to know. Using this list as an outline, I then kind of wrote a narrative, weaving formal analysis, historical and cultural context around those works of art. Let's see. Okay. And now, there's been many bitter attacks on the canon, particularly of global Western art. And I'm not going to go into detail about that. But people don't usually object to the fact that there is a canon of greatest hits. It's what those greatest hits are that they fight about. And of course, a canon of Mexican art, a list of the greatest hits of Mexican art, could be used to reinforce ideological biases or economic systems, or it could be served to dismantle them. A canon is in and of itself not one, it's not ideological in and of itself. It doesn't have a bias in and of itself. But any survey, whether you look at it as this sedimentation process or perhaps distillation, might be another word, has to be exclusionary. All books are exclusionary. All exhibitions are exclusionary as well as inclusionary. Otherwise, you end up with some sort of encyclopedic approach that is impossible to read or digest. And what somebody calls, one of my colleagues once said, Jay, you should not fetishize completeness. You know, you can never be complete. You can never tell the whole story. You can never read every book, et cetera. And so, you know, you have to let that idea of completeness go. And maybe the only thing that you can do, therefore, is be honest about what's left out. Now, because my editors in London generously allowed me to more than double the word count from 50,000 to over 100,000 words and increase the number of illustrations, I was actually able to exclude far less than I originally anticipated. Canon formation, whether in an exhibition or book, is facilitated by both time and distance. Looking back over several centuries or even several decades, one sees what was heavy enough to drop to the ground, forming sediment, and what was so light or ephemeral that it drifted away. Of course, the value of any individual work of art isn't inherently heavy or light. It is the critic who gives it weight. Genealogy matters here, too, because by looking back in time, we can tell by the frequency and authority of an image's descendants which ones were particularly important in the past and have been influential over time. So, for example, if we consider Mexican geometric abstraction of the 1970s, and this work on the left is an example by the artist Manuel Felgueres, it's hard to say who, if anyone, of that time is a canonical figure, and impossible to canonize any single work. But if we go back a century earlier, we can easily identify those noble ancestors, those works that have served as basic cultural reference over time, or that reveal particular moments in the nation's particular and cultural history, like this painting by Jose Obregón of the Discovery of Pulque, which is from 1869. It's been in almost every survey or book written on Mexican art. The big problem for the art historian, of course, is that there's not much time or distance at play when it comes to contemporary art, which often resists our inclination towards canonization. Indeed, many contemporary artists that I know, and there's a few here, are horrified by the very idea of being canonized, and some would say that, in fact, contemporary art is to be dealt with by critics and not by historians. But even in the contemporary arena, canons are being constructed through exhibitions such as the one here at the Modern, or by collectors, or by market forces, as well as by any number of publications. At the same time, however, no single show or single book could definitively canonize any single figure or image, especially because our sense of what is important in the contemporary arena continually shifts as we move forward in time. I just read an essay about the way that those big global art history surveys end, and if you look, you know, go back to the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and you look at the artists they ended with, and they said, this is the, you know, thing of the moment. In the subsequent editions, those artists of the moment got consigned to sort of footnotes. You know, as the wheel moves forward, what seems to be so important at any given moment, as you move forward and you look back, it can often seem less important with time. To understand this complex process of canonization in the field of Mexican art, one has to turn back to the 1920s, to the writing of the first survey texts on Mexican art, and to the 30s, which was the decade when the first broad exhibitions of Mexican art were organized by institutions in the United States rather than in Mexico. So the first survey texts were actually written by Mexicans, but the first big survey exhibitions were done by U.S. institutions, like MoMA in New York. In a longer version of this project, I will explore this history in further detail, but I'm going to spare you tonight some of the historical details by looking at three main of the most prominent surveys of Mexican art that were published before my own in order to better understand how everybody dealt with this concept of contemporary art. How did these earlier authors define contemporary art? And just as importantly, how did they articulate the difference between modern and contemporary art? German art historians in the 19th century, when they invented art history, used the first surveys of art history to show that the art of their own time in the 19th century was the culmination of complex paths of historical transmission. So that was the whole idea behind the survey, was to tell a story and inform people about the past, but as leading up to the present time and justify the present time, justify the art of the moment and the importance of the art of the moment through the survey. Many art historians in the first half of the 20th century, writing during the ascendancy of modernism, had an even easier time of this because they never questioned this inevitable forward march of the Eurocentric or perhaps Paris-centric avant-garde, right, as leading to some definitive moment In recent decades, in the field of art history, within the U.S. Academy and in Mexico as well, there's been a profound philosophical and methodological shift away from these teleological definitions of modernism. You know, this idea that the innovations of the Florentine Renaissance inevitably brought us to color field painting in the 1960s. That's been completely questioned. And the absence of women or people of color or all sorts of alternative groups from that kind of grand narrative has been questioned by all sorts of theories and discourses, including feminism, the civil rights movement, post-colonial theory, etc. So scholars have really been forced to take a more decentered approach where multiple narratives coexist, and an approach that would acknowledge the realities of globalization, parallel development, cross-cultural exchange, etc. What's most important for those of us working in the field of Latin American art today, I would argue, is not finding ways to construct a smooth, perfect, formal chain of associations that leads us from the beginning to the end, but to find and analyze points of friction and difference, but also parallels and points of contact within the historical record. Unlike some writers, I avoid using contemporary art as a period term or like a movement locked in a specific time, something like Romanticism or even Modernism, but rather consider how contemporary art is shaped by both chronological factors, because contemporary art, when we think about contemporary art, there has to be some sort of historical dividing line between what's contemporary and what came before contemporary. And also there are judgments of quality or relevance, which is an aesthetic line that we draw, you know. So these lines, the historical line, the aesthetic line, they're unavoidable. For even if we try for some very generic definition of what contemporary art means, something like art now, or art of today, or art of my time, we're still going to have to define what now or today or my time is and means. And that, of course, differs depending on one's age and perspective. And we also have to ask what you mean by art, art of our time. Well, what's your time and what do you think art is, right? So there's no way of getting around it. Some authors have defined contemporary art as basically everything made after 1945 or after 1960 or after 1970 or 80 or 90. And these are just different moments in some sort of timeline, and I think you get a sense that it's impossible to draw a definitive line between what's modern and contemporary here. Although 1990 seems to be a date right now, that is at least the criterion of my own book and of this exhibition. Although any of these time frames would be far longer than what would be considered contemporary in other areas like fashion, where something from one season ago is considered historical, right? So this temporal definition of contemporary is crucial because it helps define another shifting term, which is modern, which for many years was a term that covered sort of contemporary artistic practice. Like, witness the Museum of Modern Art. They were collecting contemporary art when they were founded in 1929, and we're at the Modern Art Museum of Fort Worth, which collects art produced after 1945, and it's not the Modern and Contemporary Art Museum of Fort Worth, but the Modern Museum of Fort Worth. So and today, I think modern art, and forgive the tautology, can be defined as whatever preceded contemporary art, whenever that was. And in other words, modern is really the cultural period preceding our own. So I think for most people. In surveys, it's very hard to know. I think it's been harder for people to know sometimes where to end than where to begin. The first important overviews of Mexican art all included pre-Columbian art. The first truly comprehensive survey was this book, published in 1927 by the Mexican poet José Juan Tablada, who's shown in a photograph on the right. Although rarely read or cited today, it's never been translated, this book might be considered the first illustrated source that sought to create a true canon of the highlights of Mexican art. It was written at the very beginning, at the cusp of what would be known as the Mexican Renaissance, when the great muralists began working. But Tablada does not locate the beginning of the modern period with them. He locates it back into the 19th century. He didn't have very much praise for this modern period in the 19th century. He said, well, in Mexico, this was a time of long and sleepy decadence, something like severe malnutrition, which was finally interrupted by the pictorial activity of the young painters called to decorate the great wall spaces in state buildings in the 20s. The only things Tablada redeemed from that decadent modern period, as he called it, leading up to around 1900, were folk art and a few historical paintings like that discovery of Pulque. Tablada dates the beginning of the contemporary period, as he calls it, the contemporary epoch, he says there's modern and contemporary, but for him these are temporal periods. They don't have anything to do with artistic style. The contemporary period, he says, the first contemporary artist is Julio Ruelas, who's on the left screen, a painter who died in 1907, and whose work belongs to a category in Latin America known as, and it gets confusing, modernismo, which is sort of like symbolism. It doesn't really mean modernism, which is an embrace of modernity, but symbolism and modernismo is more of a rejection of modernity, and you can see that, you know, this suffering satyr being threatened by a dragon, and then these Art Nouveau lines sweeping around. This was his artist, though, that launches a new period, a contemporary period, breaking out of the 19th century, really. And in fact, they called themselves, you know, the Modernistas, and their magazine was called, Revista Moderna. You can see Revista Moderna, 1903. So then Tablada, from this artist, he marches through a series of Vasari-like mini-biographies of the leading figures of this contemporary epoch, including the muralists José Clemente Orozco and Diego Rivera. And he leads up to artists like Abraham Angel, this painting of 1923. Most of these artists, he includes, were engaged in some way with rural or indigenous culture. So this is how Tablada ends his book, with that image on the right. That's the most modern, the most contemporary thing that he considered. Now, if we go back to the cover here of Tablada's survey, you notice that it bears an image of the Aztec war god, Huitzilopochtli, on the cover, signaling Tablada's desire to ground Mexican art as part of a continuum that stretched back to a time of myths and traditions long before recorded history. That's what he says. That this is an Aztec image, though, is crucial in that the colonial and subsequent regimes in Mexico, including the revolutionary generals who then controlled the country, all saw themselves as the heirs of that great Aztec civilization whose capital gave rise to Mexico City. 2 years later, a far more idiosyncratic but also more influential book entitled Idols Behind Altars was published in New York, 1929. The author was an American named Anita Brenner, but she was born in Aguascalientes in Mexico, and she was a key journalist and figure of her time. Brenner launches her narrative also with pre-Columbian art, and her evocative title famously situated modern Mexican visual culture in the buried but not forgotten past. And on the rarely preserved book jacket, which you see here, that placid Aztec warrior in Tablada seems to have popped out of his disc, and now he's got an axe in his hand and he's threatening this poor, startled, suffering Virgen Dolorosa. Although locked in a fictional past, the image on the cover of Brenner's book, in which an Indian is about to desecrate a Catholic statue, which reverses the idol smashing of the early colonial period, resonates with one of the biggest political events of her time, which was the anti-clerical campaigns of the Mexican government at that time, which led to something called the Cristero War, which was still raging when her book went to press. So there were actually indigenous people in communities destroying Catholic sculptures when her book was published. Idols Behind Altars is far more modern than Tablada's book. In terms of content, she looks much more broadly at art production in Mexico in the 20s, like futurism and other modernist discourses that he ignored. And it's also more modern in its prose style, which is more experimental than even that of the Tablada, who is a poet. And it reminds us that in this period, in the 20s, these dramatic cultural shifts are taking place very fast, not only in Mexico, but in other places. Although the book takes a chronological approach, Brenner rejects facile divisions of the art she discusses into pre-Columbian, colonial, modern, and contemporary units, preferring instead to emphasize cultural continuity across time and this idea that there's a sort of unbroken tradition. Instead of breaking it up into these units, there's this unbroken tradition from the Aztecs all the way up to our own time is something that has been... was extended and developed by many writers in Mexico, including the Nobel Prize poet and art critic Octavio Paz, and has been widely criticized in recent years. Brenner's book, by the way, is also physically more modern than Tablada's. Here, they're both illustrating the same image. And you can see that Brenner was really conscious of making a visual as well as textual statement. She commissioned photographs from the American photographer Edward Weston, and she also worked probably with a book designer. So Tablada's book page on the left is kind of old-fashioned. It reproduces this painting that I'll show later of the Zocalo, the downtown plaza in Mexico City, on its side. You see the caption is on the side as if it was some sort of scientific plate, whereas Brenner shows just a detail of it, which and that fragment, that detail, is really a quintessential modernist approach, looking at the detail rather than the whole thing. The most important of these early surveys, however, was written by Justino Fernandez. Although I'll focus on a book that he revised, he last revised in 1969, just before his death. It's a volume with a long genealogy. There was a first edition where he calls it Modern Art in Mexico from 1937. Then he revisited it. Now he changes the title to Modern and Contemporary Art of Mexico and published in 1952. And then in 1960s, he works with the University of Chicago Press and extends it back in time all the way through colonial and pre-Columbian to have one single book. And so it evolves over time. But in both, in all of these books, he kind of creates a dividing line between the modern and the contemporary around the Mexican Revolution and the beginning of the mural campaigns that are built in Mexico City. So that's how he locates the beginning of this contemporary art. I'm skimming here a little bit. By the way, he went through, like, these books went through about 8 or 10 editions from 1937 all the way until 1968, so that's about 30 years. And I pray that I have 30 years to update my text, correct errors, and sell more copies, but we'll see. The U.S. edition of the classic is divided into four parts, ancient, which also sort of alluded to by the cover, art, colonial, modern, and contemporary. And he defines contemporary art as art of our own time. Now, Fernandez illustrates many of the same works of art that were already canonized in the books by Tablada and Brenner. But his 1952 book, the one in the middle, is really much more detailed. He has 580 black and white images in that book in the center. The 1969 edition, ironically, even though it extends the time that's covered by centuries going through colonial and pre-Columbian, vastly reduces the number of images. So the middle book, which covers, you know, only art since, say, 1820, has almost 600 images. And the later book, which covers the whole history of Mexican art from the beginning to today, has only 183 images. So, you know, like... a third the number of images. So he, as an author, had to do this sedimentation himself to his own book. He had to filter out from all of that stuff what he thought were the greatest images. When I wrote, by the way, the U.S. edition totally omits Frida Kahlo, and none of his books talked at all about photography. Well, the two later books, anyway, did not talk about photography at all. When I wrote Art and Architecture in Mexico about a half century after Fernandez, I hardly viewed Mexico's art history as structured by the same time-honored categories. Without really taking these surveys into account, I called my last chapter Contemporary Issues, Art in Mexico Since 1990, highlighting 12 artists, seven of whom, by the way, were also selected by Andrea for the present show, and four major concerns: the found object, the copy, social critique, and a final open-ended category that allowed me to bring the story to an end called Sacrifice and Renewal in the New Millennium. So I use 1990 as an almost arbitrary dividing line, but it does reflect sort of what you could call art of my own time, since I've lived in Mexico since 1991. But I also avoided definitions or inventories, and in fact, I wrote in the book, summarizing contemporary art in Mexico over the past 20 years with any pretense to objectivity or historical perspective is an impossible task. Instead, I focused on a few artists that had captured the attention of critics and curators in Mexico as well as abroad, and whose works, I said, resonated with issues discussed elsewhere in the book. So that was the way I kind of justified the inclusion of the artists. Artists, contemporary artists, who somehow I could find ways that they resonated with historical material. And this is what I'm going to talk about now, is there are both benefits and pitfalls in taking a long rather than tightly focused view of Mexican art history. The long view requires you to skim along the surface, digesting and streamlining the latest scholarship, and taking the risk of falling into interpretive, but you also take the risk of falling into interpretive traps and inconsistencies, although I hope the errors are few. One of the greatest benefits of the long view, however, is it allows a writer to signal specific moments of connection rather than overarching continuities over time. So my book is filled with cross-references in which the reader goes along and then suddenly he or she is sent 200 pages into the future, or later in the book is thrown 50 pages earlier or 100 pages earlier to make these jumps in time. And so what I want to show finally in the last part here is just some of these connections between works of art across time and give a sense of, I think, of maybe, well, I'll talk about it, different ways of looking at contemporary art than the way we often see it in these exhibitions like the one upstairs. Sort of alternative ways of looking at it rather than, parallel ways rather than pure alternatives. So citations or cross-temporal references were common in the entire history of Mexican art, and I'm not going to go to a lot of detail here, but they were particularly common in the 1980s, and in not only in Mexico, but also in a lot of Chicano art, these specific citations of predecessors. And that's, in Mexico, this phenomenon was known as neo-Mexicanism, and these conscious references to the past were sometimes very cynical critiques of the manipulation of nationalist icons, like the Virgin of Guadalupe or the revolutionary general Emiliano Zapata. But sometimes they were a search for heroes and heroines, as in this drawing on the left by the Mexican artist Naum Zinil from 1983, in which he embraces, a self-portrait of the artist, embraces half of Frida Kahlo's famous The Two Fridas of 1939 as part of his own construction of a sexual and racial self-identity. The artists that I discuss in art and architecture in Mexico, like some but not all of those included in Mexico Inside Out, came onto the scene in the mid to late 90s. The fact that they've all been working for around 20 years allowed me to consider them historical figures, even if the specific works have not yet been canonized. If I were to have chosen artists who are even younger, and the youngest in Inside Out is only 28, my task might have been more difficult in terms of who I selected. This generation of artists is sometimes said to have rejected overt references to the classics of Mexican art, looking outward rather than inward, part of a shift towards conceptual strategies, often involving video or found objects, that shaped the arts internationally in the 90s. Most of them did reject the market-based painting that had dominated galleries in Mexico in the 80s. Although the early 90s has been seen by some as a key moment of rupture, breakage with nationalist subject matter, this can be, I think, overstated, for there was a long tradition of internationalism in 20th century Mexican art, and also, as we're going to see, many of these artists did consciously or perhaps slightly indirectly or more subtly engage with the past, engage with the icons of Mexican art history, even if it wasn't so overt as it was in the 80s. Now, we move into the contemporary artists. The earliest works of a few of the artists included in the show, among them Thomas Glassford and Gabriela Orozco, do have their roots in a sort of very subtle neo-Mexicanism, although often in very tentative ways. But they soon rejected this approach as the political situation, especially the increasing challenges to the pre after the fraudulent elections of 1988 and the implementation of a free trade agreement in 1990, and the focus of international critics began to shift. Many of these artists kind of let go of their specific references to sort of Mexican icons. Yet they and others have often engaged with history, sometimes explicitly. This is a work on the left from 1998 by Miguel Calderon. It was created for an exhibition at the National Museum of Art in downtown Mexico City. And here he recreates, using workers from the museum, cleaning workers, as well as one of the principal guards, a classic from that museum's collection of 19th century academic history paintings, subverting purposefully and poking fun of the high moral message of Gutierrez's Oath of Brutus of 1857, which, you know, is about male, the man is powerful and he's going to avenge the poor fallen victim, the woman, etc., in very crisp, clear neoclassical language. Calderon also is taking this usually marginalized museum staff, putting them into the same artificial poses as their classical ancestors, poking fun of the pretensions of art in the past, in which supposedly high, serious moral messages could be found, and perhaps also poking fun of our current attempts to find equally serious messages in much contemporary art. One of the most famous series of photographs taken in Mexico in the late 90s and early 2000s was Daniela Rossell's Ricas y Famosas, or Rich and Famous, a series called The Rich and Famous, images which were quickly embraced as emblematic of an unbridled neoliberalism that had created new fortunes and caused profound social problems. So clearly here, although the construction of these images is quite complex, and she knew the women that she was photographing and they were complicit in these portraits, obviously you can see the enormous distance between this girl and the culture that was paying homage to someone like Emiliano Zapata in the background, which is actually, she's in her father's office and he's a politician. And so she's, you know, completely kind of poking fun of that, you know, greatness of Mexican culture that looms in the background. Her images of girls posing for the camera in lavishly decorated interiors, most of dubious aesthetic taste, created long before the selfies that are so common now on Facebook and Instagram, provided a window onto a sector of Mexican society that rarely figured previously in Mexican art. These were the people that collected images of the campesinos and revolutionaries that appeared in the work, while maintaining all sorts of social and racial class prerogatives. But these young women, some of marriageable age, really are no different from those 18th century Creole aristocrats, like this woman, whose imported costumes spoke of enormous purchasing power and whose flashy coat of arms testified to the insecurities of the nouveau riche of that time. So I'm going to be doing this now through the last 5 minutes of the lecture or so, 10 minutes of the lecture, and just, these are not explicit points of influence. It's not that Daniela is looking at these 18th century portraiture, this 18th century portraiture, but that by looking at her work through the lens of that, we can start to, you know, find new meanings, new ways of thinking about her photographs, and perhaps also new ways of thinking about how those 18th century paintings are also representations of what for some people were probably the gauche nouveau riche of Mexico City, you know. So, and the example I want to show here is this comparison between another photograph by Daniela from this series of a woman posing with a servant there, or, you know, off to the side, with one of Diego Rivera's portraits of society figures and international jet setters, like this portrait from 1940 of the actress Paulette Goddard in Diego Rivera's studio. And she's there in the foreground, and her hair is being combed by this indigenous woman in the background. And the difference between this blonde in the foreground, or probably in the case of Paulette Goddard, she was a redhead, and this indigenous figure, this indigenous servant waiting there, is really the same. It really echoes directly this social, racial, and class division that you see Diego Rivera examining probably far less critically, or perhaps critically, in his 1940 portrait. Contemporary artists have also engaged in different ways with Mexico City, and this is a very fascinating topic I can only allude to with this one comparison. The godlike, dizzying aerial perspective of Melanie Smith's Spiral Cities series, and there's two paintings and a video in the show upstairs, is very similar. This aerial perspective is very similar to that of a mid-18th century painting of the Plaza Mayor, or today it's called the Zocalo, which I alluded to when I was talking about those previous surveys. Here it is in color. And you can see, whereas the anonymous artist on the right, probably a painting around 1750, and it's probably hard to read for all you in the background, but the cathedral is right here. And these are all the market vendors that used to occupy the center of the plaza. There was a sort of a permanent market here. And then this is the National Palace where the Diego Rivera murals are today. And this is the Viceroy in his carriage, and he's going in a procession from the palace over to the cathedral. And there's hundreds of figures and people selling things, and there's even some guys robbing, and there's water vendors. There's all sorts of activity going on. The artist on the right was so eager to show the cultural and economic splendors and at the city's political and religious heart, but Smith really rejects that. She shows an almost post-apocalyptic wasteland of this international-style concrete architecture devoid of monuments. The 18th century picture is also interesting because it participates in a very centralized worldview in which power was centralized in Mexico City. And in fact, we in the 18th century painting were floating, not in a helicopter, but we're sort of weirdly floating above the royal palace, which was the seat of the viceroy. And this idea of some sort of centralized point of view that's fixed and true is completely absent in Smith's vision, where she's spinning around the city and in this disoriented way, which echoes. You know, we can use that 18th century painting to understand how decentralized Smith's image is. I want to conclude with two of the most recent works included in my book and two artists that are also present in the show upstairs. These are by Teresa Margolyes and Thomas Glassford. And they're both represented in Mexico Inside Out with sculptures, but I'm going to talk about works that could not have been transported to Fort Worth, even if the curators had really wanted to. The first is the Mexican Pavilion that Teresa Margolyes did for the 53rd Venice Biennale in 2009. The whole installation, it was sort of a complex installation / performance, was called What Else Could We Talk About? And it was placed in a sort of decrepit, rented palazzo in Venice, and one of the main materials that she used for this project were cloths that had been used to soak up blood at gang shootings in the contested border city of Juarez. These dried, bloody cloths were then sort of treated, shipped to Italy, and one of them was actually hung as a flag outside here, which was sort of mocking the aristocratic and nationalist banners that usually decorate the facades of those Venetian palazzos. Although not censored, her work sent shockwaves through the official Mexican art world, which had paid for this pavilion, or sponsored this pavilion. And because these Mexican bureaucrats were used to advertising national glories more than airing the nation's dirty laundry. Now, in the still on the left, which is the inside of the pavilion, we see a man mopping the floor with water in which those blood-soaked rags had been left to soak, leaving sort of very subtle traces of death on the floor with every pass as she moved these kind of bloody, formerly bloody rags or bloody water across the floor. It doesn't really matter whether it was purified or not, and it almost doesn't matter whether there was real blood there or not. She was alluding to these very terrible materials, making art out of horrifying, terrible materials like blood, that alluded to the equally or even more terrible events along the U.S. border. But this use of terror to to allude to terrible events, and particularly the depiction of blood was very frequent in Mexican muralism, and particularly in the work of José Clemente Orozco. This is one of his murals in Guadalajara. They often depicted the same sort of violence, and Orozco in particular often refused to propose any facile solution to the problem of violence in the country, just as Margolyes refuses to offer any simple solutions. But an equally more distant, yet perhaps even more bloody reference might be found in the Mexican ex voto tradition, these devotional paintings done whether on canvas or tin, created to commemorate salvation from illness and hung in the church to testify very often to the power of particular saints to grant salvation from illness or tragedy. This is an example from 1777. It's actually in the Wellesley collection that shows a young woman in a bed on the left undergoing a brutal and bloody operation in the midst of this absolutely luxurious home. Both of these images are actually in my book, and I ask students to go back and forth between them and think about the parallels between them. What struck me only after the book was printed was the fact that this red damask covers the walls, you can see on the right side and of the painting, in these aristocratic settings, or formerly aristocratic settings. But it also allows us to rethink Margolyes' work as a sort of modern ex voto, commemorating not salvation from heaven, but perhaps salvation through art or through publicizing these sorts of events. And finally, I want to conclude this talk, as I conclude my book, with an image of Thomas